thank you very much. And I can hear that the sound is okay. And so it's a real pleasure to be here. And what you're going to hear today is a few stories, and you're going to see some photographs. And I look at my whole life as just a series of stories. And in talking to John Coxon this morning, there's a few people in the room I recognize that are both connected to some stories that I won't spend too much time on, but this is all about stories today. And John happened to sell me my very first car that I ever owned. And so, which is really neat in that just about a week ago, we were talking about our first cars with some friends. And what was your first car? What was your first car? And the two stories I told were about that first Malibu Classic, mid-70s big boat, and then the first standard car that I taught my wife before we were married how to drive a standard on. And amazingly, we ended up getting married after that. She learned how to drive a standard. And the other story is I see Milt Battersby here, who he was kind enough to rent a house that we lived in while I was in high school. And I went to school with a kid who had an indoor swimming pool. And I think his family had the only indoor swimming pool in town that I knew about at that time. Milt rented us a house that for a few weeks, we had the second indoor swimming pool in Lindsay. It was a little child's pool that was collecting water that leaked from the roof, but nonetheless, we had a pool. And so I'm going to get on, though, with some stories about Targa. And so a little bit about me. I assumed that nobody would read the stuff that I sent because I spent years in education, and nobody ever reads anything before they come to class. So I can skip over some of this stuff. But I'm a graduate of Fleming College here in Lindsay. I had my father as a teacher, and so I'm a product of the college system and went to Frost Campus. Graduated from Centennial as well because that's where I completed my apprenticeship training. And then had some really, really amazing experiences. I got out of the shop after a little while and then worked in automotive manufacturing, taught in a vocational school, have been back and forth between the college system and the private sector a couple of times. And now I'm at Centennial College. So a little bit about Centennial. Ontario's first college, created by Bill Davis when he was the Minister of Education back during the late 60s. He had this vision for something that was going to be different from university, to prepare young people for careers with practical skills. And I think the system has grown so much more than he envisioned, but he had the vision of this system. And so when we look at where we are today, 24,000 full-time students at Centennial, that's what we've grown to. We were just under 10,000 when I started there, so we've over doubled in size. And the amazing thing is even within my program areas that I run, we still have twice as many jobs available as I can put graduates out. And these are jobs that pay really good money. Employers today are not hiring someone to be a technician. They're looking for technicians, but they're looking to be for who's their next shop foreman, who's their next service manager, who's their next salesperson. They're looking two or three steps beyond. The students don't understand that, but I see it when I talk to employers. We've got 50% international students at Centennial. The interesting thing about the international students is there's a few real misconceptions. We've got people with money. We're making about the same off an international student as we do with a domestic student. When I take the tuition and the grant that the Ontario government pays for a student from Ontario, all we do is take that same amount, and that's what we charge someone coming in from overseas. The secondary language skills they have, when we look at the diversity in Toronto, the cross-cultural understanding and perspective they bring, if they go back to their own countries, they get great jobs and careers. If they stay here within Canada, we're effectively training the next generation of people, and they're paying for it. And the employers around Toronto, I've got the most diverse population you would find anywhere. We have people at our college from over 100 different ethnic and cultural backgrounds, and that reflects Toronto and the GTA and the businesses. These people, when they get jobs, will be able to serve customers in their own languages. They'll understand their customers. And so about 25% of our operating budget's from the government, 75% from student fees and in a various number of buckets. School of Transportation, of the 1,200 students we have at any given time, about 1,200 automotive students. I've got about 15 different corporate partnerships in automotive alone. I've got about another dozen corporate partnerships in all of the other program areas, from lawnmowers right up to airplanes. And so here's an example here of another graduate who all he wanted to do was become a technician. He runs the parts and service operations for FAF Group, which has 15 different retail stores, everything from Volkswagen right up to McLaren. He sits on our program advisory committee. He used to teach for us part-time when he had time. And so this is an example of what I was talking about, the employers. There aren't enough. Everyone my age who's leaving the workforce, we don't have the same numbers coming through to replace them, which when we take a look long-term, that's going to affect our economy. It's going to affect growth. So for now, the more people we can get in the door and out, there's work for them. So an example with TTC, we've got a program with bus technicians. We're the only bus technician program in North America that specializes in buses. Truck and coach are put together, and in most colleges, 19 out of 20 apprentices coming through are going to work on trucks. You can't build a program for that 1 out of 20 people that are actually going to spend their entire career on buses. Within the GTA, we can do that, and TTC's, they're donating a hybrid vehicle or a hybrid bus to Centennial. I'm on vacation, but I just got an email just a couple of days ago that says, we've got the bus approved. You're going to get it. And electric is the next place we're going. Light rail transit's the next. Centennial College, and then the other cool thing, Alan Pritchard, who's right here, they're all Centennial grads. Alan's the first technician to actually be the superintendent of the entire fleet maintenance for TTC. That's been an engineer's job up until him. He's the very first. He was our alumnus of distinction this year at our graduation. And so then when we take a look at Air Canada, similar story. Brad Warren graduated in the early 90s. He runs maintenance for Air Canada right around the world. We were in his hangar out at, we've got a partnership program with them that's a co-op program, and he's planning maintenance around the world for Air Canada, and he's also maintaining other people's planes that break down when they're in Toronto or wherever he's got hangars. And again, a college-trained technician who then moved up through the ranks in management. And so I'm split between two campuses. Our very newest campus for Centennial, we're the largest trainer of aviation maintenance engineers in Ontario. We're among the largest. We're number two in Canada. And so we've got about 400 aviation maintenance technicians at any given time. And that's a plane that Bombardier's donated to us, a regional jet. And the campus was still under construction. But we spent $72 million on an old de Havilland building. They built mosquito bombers in the Second World War in this building. They built Twin Otters up until the mid-80s. Spar Aerospace then took it over. And then since then, it's been vacant until we took it over and built our new campus there. So Targa, Newfoundland, you've heard a little bit about it. It's interesting. When I look at motorsports and auto racing. And I've always loved car racing from the days when I've had slot cars when I was a kid. Those were the days of James Hunt, Niki Lauda, and F1, the real glory days. And it was either NASCAR with Richard Petty, or it was Al Unser, or it was F1, and always loved it. With some of our corporate partnerships, gotten lots of free tickets or complimentary passes for the Canadian Tire Motorsports Park or Mossport. And the one thing that really strikes me about all levels of auto racing, and I was saying this to someone today, it's either for really rich hobbyists. 95% of the people involved are either really rich hobbyists who just love that and they've got the money that they can afford to, or you've got really poor enthusiasts who haven't got two nickels to rub together because everything they get goes into getting onto the circuit and staying on the circuit, or about 5% actually get sponsorships and can actually earn a living doing it. So it's no different than golf or any of the other things we look at as a pastime. Look at how much some people make, at the money that goes in, the corporate sponsorships. Most of that gets eaten by a select few. And so how did we get into this? It's based on a race in Tasmania since 1992 that's called Targa. And Tasmania is very similar to Newfoundland in Canada. It's isolated from the rest of Australia. It started as a colony. So you've got a colony, then you've got another state that's isolated from that colony on an island. People have to become very self-reliant. They get used to their own way of doing things. And in Australia, they look at Tasmania in the same way we look at Newfoundland. There's no other province. I've worked right across this country. There's no other province in Canada where people would say, okay, yeah, shut down the roads, and then, oh yeah, come on into the cities, use these laneways as well, right by the white picket fences, try not to smash any of them, and we'll try to keep the people off the roads while you're racing through, and then you come on through. And there's no other place that would do that. Tasmania is the same. And so Jim Kenzie had this vision, and he connected up with someone in Newfoundland about 10 years later in 2002. And so they created a similar event for North America called Targa. And it is a real test of endurance. Vehicles and drivers must drive the cars to and from all locations. Towing or trailering, you're disqualified. You're not allowed wet or dry tires, which is another challenge. You can have 6 tires that have to last you the whole week. You're allowed 5 rims that have to last you the whole week. And when we get through in and I show you some photos, it's really a test of endurance. In some cases, the people who drive maybe a little bit slower, a little more carefully, miss the really big potholes and their car hangs into the end of the week, are quite often the ones that end up on the podium. And you'll get people in really, really expensive modified vehicles that will make it onto the podium, and then you'll see others in the same boat that just don't make it because their car didn't last the week. And so it's a real test of endurance. And so here's Jim Kenzie's car. He's run this a number of times. He used to run minis. Now he's connected with Nissan. The irony is that when I was with Nissan, I left Nissan as technical training manager for Nissan Canada. We hated Jim Kenzie. He hated Nissans. He used to just trash us in our new models that came out. And the funny thing is when he left Mini, he picked a vehicle that's very similar in configuration to a Mini with a bit less power. So a nice light front-wheel drive vehicle that can really handle well. And so he ended up with a Juke. So it looks kind of quirky, but it handles in a very, very similar way to how a Mini handles. And so he's affiliated with Nissan, and he's part of the Hume team. It was a corporate partnership that kind of brought us together. I was working on the aviation project, we called it. We didn't even have a campus back then. We had this plan or vision, and we were in the discussions of a campus up at Downsview. And it was our government relations and external relations guy that came to me who he's the one who usually is out there schmoozing, trying to figure out where should Centennial, where can we get some support for aviation. And he ended up talking to someone from Hume Media who said, Centennial, wow, we need your help. We need some help in our team for Targa. And he comes to me and he says, hey, Alan, have you ever heard of Targa? Of course I've heard of Targa. This guy'd never heard of it before, because unless you're really into that kind of stuff, Targa is kind of on the same level as Pikes Peak out in the U.S. or somewhere like that, or the Baja racing down in Lower California. So, of course I've heard of it. Oh, well, we got a team from Scarborough that's just 2 kilometers over from where you are. It's a media company that's interested in seeing if there's a way we can work together. So we had a faculty, Garrett Nalepka, was one of our faculty in one of our corporate programs, who he spent his summer with a Maserati team on the Road America circuit. And so Garrett would go all over North America with the team. He was a crew chief. And that's where I started to learn, you got to have money to do this. The driver owned a tech company in Mississauga, was a multimillionaire. And Garrett was there. He was their lead technician. And so I talked to Garrett. He was the first guy I went to. Before Road America and the Maserati team he was with a Viper team, because he was from our Chrysler program, and he was on a Viper-sponsored team in the same series a few years earlier. And so Garrett, we talked to him, connected him with Hume Media. They paid all his expenses out the first year just to check it out. And I was looking at this thinking, we've got some money for student mobility, which is experiential learning. Normally it's sending someone to Italy for the summer or for a semester, or to South Korea for a semester to study. Study abroad is normally what we do it with. But I was looking and thinking, wow, they're pushing me to get more students into these student mobility projects, because the money's there from the provincial government, and we fund it ourselves now internally. But I thought, if I could get that to support the students going to Targa, we might be on to something. And so Hume paid Garrett to go out the first year just to check it out. He came back, said, this is great, team we're with is good, everything's legit. So the next year we sent him out with some students, and it just grew year after year. Now we have 2 sets of tools. We have 2 faculty, of which I cover off one of the faculty spots. Garrett covers off the other. We take 4 students. And we have funding from within the college that covers the costs of the students. We take 1% of all of our international tuition and put it into a pot that we can then apply for student mobility projects and students learning somewhere else outside of Centennial. And then Hume Media pays for me and Garrett's expenses. So we're not costing the college anything, and our funds are going just to the students to cover it. And so we have a way of selecting students from 4 different programs, and each year we get a crew of students out. We divide up into 2 teams with 2 service vehicles, and we leapfrog around so that when we've got 1 service vehicle covering 1 location, we get another service vehicle to the next location. And I'll talk a little bit more about that after. So we've got Jim Kenzie on our team this year. He was on our team last year. And then Hume has 4 vehicles that they put in, 2 Minis and 2 BMW M3s. They've sold one of the BMW M3s this year, so they're just going to have 3 vehicles, 2 Minis and 2 Mini Cooper S's, and 1 BMW M3, and Kenzie's going to be our 4th person. So 3 divisions. And so there's a division called touring. You get no points. You just get to charge around on the roads of Newfoundland and through the towns at breakneck speed, breaking all of the rules with nobody else on the road for the fun of it. You pay your fees and you get to do that. And some people bring some pretty interesting cars. We had a father and son group in last year. The son just got his driver's license. The father sold his publishing business. He had a McLaren. And he got talking to somebody, and somebody said, I really wouldn't take my McLaren on Target if I was you. So a week before, he bought, at the Jaguar dealer in St. John's, he hadn't even looked at the car, he bought an F-type Jag that he picked up when he arrived in St. John's. They'd PDI'd it. They gave it to him. And Garrett, our other crew chief, installed the trip computer on it for him while we were there the first night in the arena. He'd never even driven this thing before, and him and his son took it through. Grand Touring and Targa class are both points classes. You get medals, and you're going for medals and prizes there. Grand Touring means they're street vehicles, and they're timed with medals, and I didn't do spell check, medals awarded. Targa class is a different category. Targa class is for modified vehicles. The speed limits with Targa class are much higher. Grand Touring, you get penalized if you come in too fast. You get penalized if you come in too slow. You're going for a specific time for each leg. And through the week, they make the times tighter and tighter and harder to get. So you have to go faster and faster throughout the week in order to make the times they set in Grand Touring. Targa class is all-out race. Targa class is just the fastest one wins. So you get points as well. You're penalized with points for going too slow. But if everyone comes in under the points, it's the fastest times then that win. And so typically, Targa's all-out race. Targa class is 200 kilometers is your fastest you're allowed to go. And Grand Touring, 160 kilometers is the fastest you're allowed to go. If you're behind your times, you can't speed to make up the times because they've got speed traps, radar stations throughout the course in the areas where you would go faster. And so they've got a pretty good way of keeping you honest. And so Targa class has three classes. You have vintage with over 25 years old. You have modern, which is newer vehicles with moderate modifications. And then you've got open with anything you want to put in, you can put into open. How do you get from point A to point B? It's like an old rally. You've got a way that you're reading the sheets. If you're driving by vision, you haven't got a hope. And so, because you will not make the times. So you've got to be going way too fast to even see the corners and to see how hard the corners are. So you've got to drive with your co-driver. Some of the people that aren't as serious swap back and forth between navigator and driver, but any of the ones that are really serious and win, you have people who are excellent navigators, you have people who are excellent drivers, and they just stick to their job. And so, and you have both of them available, so when a team loses somebody, they'll be on the phone to reach out through the network. I need a navigator for one of my cars. Can you find me one who's available? And so you have the navigators telling you, and they've got a system where they tell you how tight the corner is and what's coming up next, and you listen to them. And occasionally the navigator says left when he means right, and you end up with somebody in someone's front lawn when that happens. So here's our team of cars. We've got two minis. The minis are the most fun to drive. I've driven them all, and I've driven them all at really high speeds. And the minis, I have to say, are the most fun. The BMW M3s are the most scary because the M3s are pretty heavily modified. Anything in Targa class has to have a roll cage in it. It has to have a fire suppression system. It has to have a fuel cell in it if you're going to be in Targa class. And so these cars all have full roll cages, fuel cells, fire suppression. And the BMW M3s the suspension in them would shake the fillings out of your teeth if you drove them on normal roads during the day. And so they're not comfortable, but boy, they are fast. And so that's our team. And so there's Garrett. And there's Randy. These have all graduated, Juan. And we've got Leanna and Andrew, all from four different programs. The cool thing about Yuan is he's a Korean student. So here's a student over as an international student, and in between year one and two, he got an all-expenses-paid trip to Newfoundland to be part of the team. And so they go through, we have an interview process for the students. We're not looking for the most technically savvy students. You're looking for someone who is going to be reliable, somebody who's going to do what they're told, someone who's going to ask questions when they don't know something. And at the end of the day, the bulk of the repairs we're doing aren't rocket science. I used to teach advanced diagnostic courses to Ford and Nissan technicians. That's not the stuff. 90% of the stuff we're doing here is basic routine work, but you got to make sure it's right, and you got to be able to very quickly look at it and see if it's okay or not okay. That's the critical part. And then the other part is the ability to cope with sleep deprivation, because they're driving for about 12 hours a day, and when they get back to the arena at night, it goes around to different towns, different arenas. We may not get the cars to do any work till about 7 o'clock at night. They're up at 5 the next morning doing their breathalyzers. So in some cases, we're working from 7 o'clock to 1 o'clock doing work if they've done any repairs or any serious damage to the vehicles. If it's really light work, we might get in by 10 o'clock. But if they've done some heavy damage, we might be up pretty late. And so the students have to be able to deal with that. We have to be able to deal with that. You got to be able to catch 10 minutes of sleep in between legs at lunchtime, whenever. And so so we've got John Hume Sr. He drives one of the minis. And so he's won multiple years in his category. John Jr. drives one of the M3s, the blue one. And John won. He's won his category the last 2 years in the modern division. And John Senior's won multiple years in the GT division. So they go over the rules, and there's a meeting every morning about what towns you're going into, what you can expect, where you're going to be, just a bit of a heads up. They get the books the night before. Some of the really serious drivers are out on the circuit driving it the night before at low speeds, just getting a sense on what it looks like. Others who've been there year after year and know the circuits or the places they've been don't need to do that. And then others who are just there for the first time are doing it all fresh the first time. And so they go through what you can expect. Then they make sure everybody's sober. You've got to be zeros. There's no limit whatsoever. So during the week, they don't drink at all. At least the ones that are seasoned and know what they're doing don't drink at all. If you've got any alcohol, you're not allowed to race or drive. And so now the fun stuff. You get all kinds of weather, and because you can't choose wet tires and dry tires, you never know what you're going to get in Newfoundland. Because you've got open stretches of road where you're getting up to a couple of hundred kilometers an hour, and you're getting lots of really rough open road, and then you're getting into the cities and towns where it's super tight and technical, they usually look for a tire that is really all round, works in a lot of different conditions. The ones that are going with really all-out dry pavement tires don't do very well because you get lots of rain in Newfoundland. And so, and you've got lots of, you can see where the pavement's breaking up, but they'll be taking these stretches at well over 100 to 150 kilometers an hour. You're right, beautiful scenery. You're winding through beautiful roads along the shoreline. You're winding through places just in the middle of the forest, in the middle of nowhere. And then you're through little towns as well. So you've got a little bit of everything. We go to three or four different places around the island. And if the town is not fully supportive of Targa, they don't go back or they don't go there at all. You need the cooperation of the town because they shut the roads down about an hour before you begin. Then they have people the day before, they're flagging, or probably about 3 hours before, they're flagging the roads with yellow and red tape so that everyone knows the roads are closed. They then run safety vehicles or circuit vehicles through twice each way to make sure nobody's on the road. And so if the town's not supportive of that and okay with that, they usually know between 10 and noon in this town, you either be out or you're stuck in. And some of the towns are not good with that, and the towns they go to are good with that. So we've been shut. We've canceled legs in a number of places since I've been involved with it, and they just don't go back the next year. So it's really critical. Then you'll have really good places where they're supportive of it, but the roads just get too damaged and are in too rough a shape. So when they hit a certain point where they become too dangerous, they have to find new places. So they're constantly looking each year, and they'll know certain places are not going back to and new places they'll go to. And so they usually, about a third of it is on the Avalon Peninsula around Conception Bay in some nice little towns around there. Then about a third of it is up around the Clarenville, Trinity Bay area. So that's about 2.5-3 hours northeast. You're up towards Trinity and Bonavista, and we usually hunker down in Clarenville. And then usually a third of it on the Buren Peninsula, which the Buren Peninsula runs down to where you catch the ferry to St. Pierre and Miquelon, and Marystown's the home base for that. So we've usually got a home base for each third, and that's what it looks like. And usually by the time they've done all their transits between areas, there's usually about 1,500 kilometers of actual timed driving, and then there's probably about another 600 kilometers of transits in between from point A to point B, where you're going from location to location. At lunchtime, community halls and churches in all the little towns, they target pays for lunch. And so the towns generate revenue that way. They provide lunch. We get roast beef, we get turkey, we get cod, we get anything if we're lucky enough that we've got time that we can eat, if there's nothing broken that has to be fixed at lunchtime. And occasionally when we don't get lunch, the drivers will bring us back something that we'll eat in between. And so this is Justin and John Jr., who are in one of the BMWs. And they usually also do a donation. So they'll usually have a boot. It's usually like a rubber boot that people will donate funds in each town they go through. So in one of the towns we were in, they were looking for money to buy a fire truck for the local fire department. A Ram 1500 was what their fire truck was at that time. So it was a pickup truck, and they were looking to buy a proper fire truck. And that's a couple of our students with a couple of the people that lived in the town. I got a chance to talk to one of them. One of them ran a local hardware store since he was in this gentleman here. Since he was in his early 20s and got married, ran a local hardware business and then ran a sawmill as well. So really interesting stories when you meet the people. The one thing you really notice about Newfoundland is the subsistence fishing lifestyle when you get into the small towns. It was, I had no idea. I lived in Papua New Guinea for 2.5 years, and there were places where people lived where there was no running water, there was no hydro, they had no real cash income except the fish they sold once a year, and none of their income would be spent on food. They might buy flour, but they wouldn't buy anything else, because the money went into fishing gear and nets for the next year that they needed. So if you didn't grow it or catch it, you didn't eat. And really interesting when you see some of these places. And they would talk in some of the places we'd be at. The road just came. I remember when the road came through here in 1998, where in one of the towns that we were, I think it was Petty Fort, the road came through in the late 90s. Prior to that, it was a 9-kilometer boat ride to where a wharf was where they parked their truck or their car if they had to get into town. Interesting. And then in the towns, here's a sense of a run through a town where you see you've got a Lancer Evo behind. That's a really serious vehicle from Ontario that's there every year. A Subaru STI behind that. And then this is John Jr.'s BMW M3. On the open roads as well, just beautiful, spectacular scenery. And then some really cool vehicles as well. Like here's one where these are lined up. And the stories, and I'll talk about the Morris Mini after, but that little 911, and that is a late 80s or very early 90s 911, air-cooled, and behind the Evo, two guys that were probably about my age, they built this car for about a year and a half, planning to go to Targa. They were heading out in North Carolina last year in September as a hurricane was coming in. And so their wives were left to look after the houses while they're on the road with a trailer taking a 911 up to Newfoundland. And they were telling me about that, and it was really, really a funny story because they didn't even finish the car in time. They had this, they paid their fees, they were committed, they finished the last few odds and ends on this vehicle when they were there in Newfoundland. They got there a few days early and continued working on it because, as any do-it-yourself projects go, they just ran a little bit behind. And interesting, guys, they had no starter on that vehicle, so they had to push start that thing every time they wanted to get it going. They had a timing chain tensioner went on it halfway through the week, and they jammed a bolt in the chain tensioner to keep the thing going so they could finish. And they did finish, which was kind of neat. Here's a lineup before you start. So 30 seconds in between each car. The faster cars in each class go first because they don't want anyone who's slower to slow a faster car behind them down. So if you're in last place in your division, you're the first one going, and then they go progressively faster. And you'll get cars that are bunched up. You'll get cars that pass each other, but they want to keep that to a minimum. And so the lineups, before they start, they've got a computer. And they've got a Christmas tree that counts down that's just connected to the computer, and then they've got an optical sensor at the other end that's connected to the same computer, and so they're using satellite internet to keep everything connected for the timing of the vehicles. And so then in between each leg, we're checking with the drivers on how's the vehicle handling, what's wrong, because we're trying to get a sense on do we need to fix anything now or is there anything we need to spend extra time on at nighttime when we get back to the arena. And so we'll usually have someone with usually a clipboard, and we have a set of service reports that they do that as each one comes through. And if the driver says everything's good, that's good, move on. If they say, I think it's pulling to one side or one way, we're quick, over to the side, and we're checking tire pressures, making sure everything looks okay. And then you get them onto the next leg. Because we only have about 15 to 20 minutes in between each leg. And we do lift them up. We've got jacks, we've got stands, we've got electric impact guns, and if we got to pull something apart, we pull it apart. But at the end, you're checking to see how things are going. And so, and again, lots of waiting around. And there's me with Kenzie just talking about how things are going, or we might even be talking about where he's heading next, or something completely different. And then more waiting, we might be between legs where we've gone in there first and we're in at the very end of the run at the town and the cars are going to come through in. And so we have to get in before they shut the roads down, so we might be in there for an hour and a half, 2 hours waiting. And so we've got lots and lots of beautiful pictures and more waiting. And so we're in another town here where we're waiting for the cars to come in. Some things never change. So there's one of the students we've got who he's practicing his stone skipping skills while we're waiting for the cars to come in. And it's funny, we just caught that picture of him. And so beautiful, beautiful scenery. So it reminded me a lot of Vancouver Island where we lived, some of the little tiny villages on Vancouver Island, only the mountains weren't quite as tall out here, but just absolutely beautiful scenery and beautiful little fishing villages that in the old days weren't even connected by roads. And this is a spot we thought, you know what, we got an hour and a half or so before the cars come in. Let's go for a walk through. We saw some rivers and some waterfalls, and that's a salmon river. And we talked to one of the locals who talked about the salmon that run there. We went on another walk. We were looking for the graveyard. We found the original graveyard, or we found a newer graveyard that went back to the early 1900s, late 1800s, but this town had been here since the 1700s. And we said to an old guy, we said, we've been to the graveyard already. Where's the old cemetery from the original town? And so he told us it was up over the mountain in between two towns right in the middle of nowhere. You had to walk up over the mountain. Both of the towns shared the same church. Both of the towns shared the same school. And the other town was about an hour and a half walk away. And so so we went up looking for the original cemetery. Never found it, but lady slippers all over the place, which are kind of like Venus fly traps, just in what was really a peat bog was what we were standing in, right in the middle of it in the mountains. It's just beautiful. So back to the event. Here's a town of Brigus. They fixed up this bridge. Last year they redid it. The year before, you had a ramp at each end of the bridge, and the cars, a beautiful spot to watch, the cars would all take air as they hit. And the cars, the less experienced drivers would take the air, and they would bottom out at the other side, and you would do a lot of damage. And so the really experienced drivers would come up, hammer the brakes, and then they would hit the throttle again as fast as they could as soon as they're at the ramp and get going again, because they knew what would happen. And so in the arena at the end of the day, we have a series of service checks that everything has to go through, and then we look at the service reports for what has the driver noted and what's come up that needs to be done. And so we've got Kenzie's car in the back. We got this. We would usually take a section of the arena. And during the arenas, when you're back in, when you're in the different towns, they do a car show so that the locals can come through, talk to the drivers, have a look at the cars, look at the different vehicles. Because in some cases, we've got everything from old vintage cars from the, like muscle cars from the 60s, right on through to like the F-Type Jag that the guy just picked up a week earlier at the local dealer, and everything in between. And so suspension damage is probably the most common, because in some cases, when they're at 160 or 180 kilometers or an hour, and they'll hit some bumps and bottom out, or they'll hit a pothole and bend some steering components, that's the stuff. And then bending rims. Last year, we had no bent rims. The year before, we had bent rims like you wouldn't believe. And again, we're only allowed 5 rims. So we're putting the worst ones by the end of the week in the spots where they'll cause the least problems. And so different town, different arena. We were doing a midweek brake job on the blue car here, but we were doing brake inspections on everything. And so on the road between legs, you can't get premium fuel in a lot of towns. If you get premium fuel in some towns, it could be 6 months or 9 months old because they just don't sell a lot of it. So this was a vehicle that we didn't put enough octane booster in, and we put some in, but we didn't put quite enough in. And they were in between the transit, and they filled the tank, where, again, the people who are really experienced with Targa, if you're getting into a town in the middle of nowhere and you're empty, you look and say, okay, I've got 150 kilometers I've got to go. I'm going to put in 15 liters. That's it. I'm not putting anything in because I don't trust this fuel. And so whereas the people who don't know and haven't got that experience, they're filling up the tank, and you don't know what you're getting in some cases. So this was a case where that happened. We didn't have enough octane booster, and they blew a piston. So we were at the side of the road. We got the We got the top of the engine off to confirm it wasn't valve train. It was no compression in one piston. They had a hole in it. So this was one vehicle this year that didn't finish. The year before, we had two vehicles that didn't finish. They both crashed out. No one was hurt, but they couldn't be fixed. And this one was... So last year, we had four out of five cars finished, and all four out of five cars that finished got medals in their categories. Two of them won. And so, fast tour class, no points, just along for the ride. This guy, I think, was about maybe 70 years old from Alberta, retired. This was a custom car he had built. It was so full custom car, and so it looked like an old hot rod, but it was brand new. He brought this out just for Targa, and it was in the fast tour class. And he made it through to the end of the week and took things pretty easy, but he had lots of fun. Another one, here's a Porsche Cayman that was in the fast tour class. And again, they just stickered it up, threw it on and in just to have fun. Here's another one that was in the fast tour class. This guy, I talked to him for quite a bit because I used to work for Nissan, so I've got a soft spot for old Zed cars. He was considering going in to the... to the GT or to the Targa Vintage class, and we were talking about this. And he, after going through in fast tour, he decided no. He said, "I've seen these roads at moderate speed. I don't want to drive them again at high speed with my baby." So he tried it, did it, survived, and then decided, you know what? That's enough. I'll just keep this car and enjoy it. This is a team that comes up from the Turks and Caicos. So about a third of the vehicles are from Newfoundland, about a third from the rest of Canada, and about a third from anywhere, from the Caribbean to the U.S. to the U.K., and so, and then they bring them over. And because the roads are closed off, you can have a car that's not street legal on, and you're fine. You just can't drive it once the event's gone. But when the event's running, they'll let you transit it. They'll let you do whatever you want. So this is a group here that was in the open class. They had two Lotus Elises. And it's funny how small a world it is. My mother-in-law lived in the Turks and Caicos for about 10 years. My brother-in-law went down with his wife to just be closer to the in-laws and parents. And he ran a rental store in the Turks and Caicos for about maybe 10, 12 years. And this was a guy that owned a number of hotels in the Turks and Caicos and just loved auto racing. And so he went to a lot of events, and he had a maintenance crew of two mechanics that he would hire for this event that would come along. They had their whole garage in a trailer, so they had all their tool chests. They had cherry pickers for the engines. They had spare engines and transmissions. The Lotus here spun out off the road, and the guy who was driving, as soon as I described it to Brent and Susie, they said, "Oh yeah, I think Steve, we know Steve. Yeah, he was the guy that owned this hotel, and we knew he was into racing." And so it's a small world. And the funny thing is where they spun off the road was about 400 feet from that "please drive carefully" sign as they were coming in. So if they were closer, I could have got them in the same picture with the sign, but they were a little bit too far. So these two brothers were from San Francisco. They built this old Morris Mini, and so Morris and Austin both built Minis, and so they had an old Morris Mini. They had a VTEC Honda 1.6 engine in this that had about 230 horsepower in the back. They couldn't get speed-rated tires. Those are lawn and garden tires that they've got on there for like a little John Deere garden tractor. They could not get the speed-rated tires, and they were in the vintage class, and they didn't finish at the end of the year. They took their clutch out before the end of the week. So they made it to the last day. It was a shame, because if they'd made it one more day, they would have finished. But they had lots of fun. And the one brother, This one, he was born in Campbell River in the hospital in Campbell River where my wife worked when we lived in Vancouver Island. He was born in Campbell River because his dad was a doctor and working up there at the time. And then his dad moved down to the States to San Francisco, and they were both these guys were, one of them was a stay-at-home mom because the wife had a really good job, and stay-at-home dad, and the other one worked in the tech sector. These were the two guys, I haven't got a picture of them, they had the most fun. These were two guys in their 60s who lived on an island off the coast of San Francisco. And if you talk about a little old lady's car, this is a 1981 Ford Fairmont. We had a car that was my mom's car in around the same time. It was a red one, and it had a little six-cylinder engine in it, if I remember correctly. This one had a six-cylinder engine in it when they got it. They put a 427 in it, and they built this. And so they had a 427 in it. They had a locking rear end, and then they had a C6 three-speed automatic transmission. And these two guys had a blast. They built this car. Then they actually drove this car across to Newfoundland on a road trip, did Targa, then drove back. And so they had lots of fun. And so this Subaru STI at this end was in the fast tour class. And if you go to a website, and if you look up Targa Hume Media 2018, you'll get to the Hume Media's video. It's about a 16-minute video. They've got GoPro footage while you're in a vehicle, so you can see what it's like while you're in a vehicle heading down. They've also got a clip of this car going end over end on the first day. It did about two end over ends, landed on its roof. And again, they caught the edge of a wall when they went around a corner and they lost control, oversteered, got into the wall, and then flipped end over end. Driver was fine, but the co-driver was fine, but that car didn't make it through the week. A vintage Spectator. So this guy's got a Targa hat on, and he's the one who told us about the cemetery, where the old cemetery was. His vintage Targa hat was from last year's race. And so we were in this town for about two hours prior to the race because they were shutting the road down. And so we just hung around, went for a walk, and when we talked to this guy, we saw his boat. He had an old Cummins PT big cam engine, so from 1970s inline six Cummins driving his boat that ran his fishing boat. He was a fisherman. That hat he was wearing, I noticed it from the previous year. We had one of our cars that crashed out in this town. It was a Mini, and he went right away as a spectator to. It was a female driver we had, Ruth Thorogood, and she took air, landed on a front tire where they already had some bent steering components, and when she landed right on the wheel, outside corner of the wheel, steering. It just folded the tire over and pancaked it. Just the suspension parts broke, the control arm broke, and then she went into a wall and crashed. And she wasn't really hurt. It was at the start of the race, and but she was a little bit just confused when it happened. He helped her out of the car, and she gave him the hat as a thank you, and that was what he said he'd worn ever since. That was his ball cap. And it was funny because we were talking, and where'd you get that hat? And he starts describing the situation. I was at a different spot that day. Garrett had the other, he was with the service truck in there when this happened. And as soon as he started to describe it, I thought, that was Ruth's car. I said, I know that person. And we were talking about it, and she gave him a hat. And so modern class, which is what Jim Kenzie was in, and Kenzie was third place in modern, and so he got the bronze medal in modern class. After it's all over, John won his, or John Jr. won his category for the second year in a row in the modern Targa class. John Sr., this was the, he usually wins in the GT class, and he had a new co-driver this year. Darcy was brand new. He had had a co-driver with him or a navigator for about the last 4 or 5 years, the two of them. they knew each other really well. And so last year, with a new co-driver, he came in second instead of first. And so Darcy's back with him this year. So we're hoping it was really tight in his class with the GTs. And so then the medals and awards, they've got a gala in St. John's at the end of the week. I haven't got a picture of downtown St. John's, but it ends right downtown in the middle of town on George Street, where it ends. And so and then on the Saturday night, that's the gala. And so I just took a picture of some people after. Here's our team, Team Hume. And so with the service crew in the front, the drivers in the back. And so that's it. And then I'm back this year, so I was going to let somebody else go, but Garrett, the other crew chief, said that he doesn't want to train another faculty, so I'm back again this year. Because I thought, it's fun. Like, school starts up, we get all our students in, and there's lots going on at the school, so it's a busy time of year. So I thought, you know what, let someone else go and have some fun. Because to get paid to get to go to this it's a blast. And with the students, I get to meet students who I'm walking through the hall for the next year, and every time I see them, it's, hey, how are you doing? How are things going? And I get to hear all about how their experience is in their programs when we're sitting around waiting or when we're working. And then when things are really dicey, the biggest things we had last year with the biggest breakdown was probably we lost on the BMW M3, the blue one, we lost an accessory drive belt the second last race. So the engine overheated. And so the engine was halfway through, he lost it, which means he lost his power steering. And if you watch the Hume video at about 16 minutes into the video, you'll see they put a section in, you'll see with John screaming at Justin, I've got no power steering. I've got no power steering. And he's just manhandling the steering through the rest of that. This is in the town, which means it's lots of really sharp corners. And then his engine was overheated and boiled over by the time they got there. We had 15 minutes there till he had to start again, 5 kilometers up the road on the last leg. And so we keep spare parts in, and some spare parts are in the service vehicles, others are in the vehicle. So we had a drive belt for him in the vehicle. And so the scars, I had blisters all over my arms because you're just right in there. And so those scars, I was looking at them this morning, and they're gone now. But we got his belt changed for him. We had to take the shroud off, the fan out. We had to cut through the air conditioning belt, and we got the belt on. We got it all back together, and he got back to the next race, and he was good. He ended up winning his class, so that was and then we had some suspension parts break at the same time on some others, and so Garrett and the other team were checking out the suspension. And all you're doing there, we thought it was rattling, and you'll see this as well on the video. We thought it was parking brake pads had come loose and were rattling inside the brake drum because they have disc brakes as service brakes and then drum brakes for parking. It ended up being a stabilizer link, but they pulled it up, they inspected the wheels, they checked the service brakes, it's good, and then you're going. And even with John Jr.'s overheated engine, like, he doesn't care. If you've gone through all week, if you spent $20,000 to be out there, like, if you cook your engine, you cook your engine, but you don't stop because you're worried about your engine. So by the time we had his belt changed, we could get the rab cap off. We just topped it up with water. We tightened it back up and sent him on his way. So it was, and he was okay. But and at the end, like, if you blow a tire and you're on the race, you just keep going on the rim. So because if you don't, you've disqualified. So you're just gonna slow down, drive safely, but you got to finish because you may still be in the points. So that's it. So any questions? I'd be happy to take any questions. Okay, back corner. No, this is all, Minnie used to sponsor it and give $3,000 or $4,000 for one of the teams, but there's no real cash in this. This is all these are enthusiasts who just they want the bragging rights. Whether you finished Targa, whether you've medaled in Targa, so there's no money in this, and so it costs you. It probably costs you if you're going to do it on the cheap. It's going to cost you $8,000 to $10,000 just for your entry fee, which most of that's insurance, because every town has volunteers. All the people that run this thing are volunteers. They take their vacation during that time. The people and so it's all run on pretty much a shoestring. Most of the money goes into either the meals for the towns you're going through or insurance that they pay for. And so so there's no real money in this. People are doing it just because they love doing it. And so and that goes back to most auto racing. Nobody does it to actually win something, because I go back to even in racing where they have decent prize money in racing, that you got a few people who are getting most of that, and most of the people that are in it just because that's what they want to do. Yeah, yeah. And back corner had a hand up. It varies program by program, and they come from all over the world. So my guess would be probably maybe 50% of them would like to do that. And of the 50% that would like to do that, I would say probably maybe 2/3 of them actually find something and make that work. And then 50% will go back home, and they'll take those skills they have back home. And so it's generally about half. I'm probably higher than others because, like, if you're coming out of an aviation maintenance engineering program, if you're coming out of a truck and coach program, you've got employers lining up for the students and the grads right now. There is just such a shortage of them. And so so international students in my area are really good. When you start getting into business or places like that, not as much. When you get into hospitality, again, lots of jobs in hospitality for the international students. So it varies program to program. Yes. Oh, the race is the third week of September. So it starts on the 22nd this year. And I think it used to be on Speed Vision or Speed Channel. I'm not sure which channel has it this year. So they have it on TV as well. If you go on to YouTube, they're doing videos on YouTube. You'll find lots of stuff. And Hugh Media is probably the best, because Hugh Media, that's their business, is media. So they're putting stuff out all the time on YouTube. If you do a search for Hugh Media Targa on YouTube, you'll find lots of cool stuff. H-U-M-E. And okay, we had another hand up. Yes. Yeah, there are. There's some really good spectator areas here. So when you get into the towns, typically within the towns, all the front lawns, people's front porches, you'll get places that are really good. When you get into places that are outside of towns, you'll have there's a whole group of spectators that kind of follow this around, and they'll find places where they can stand somewhere up high on a clearing and see the cars go. Yeah. Yes. Jim Kenzie. Oh, Jim Kenzie's terrific. Yeah. He is, yeah. Jim is a real car enthusiast. He's got stories about races he's been to. He's got stories about Targa, and he's been great for Targa. He was one of the champions that got it going. So he's a really, really interesting person. And technically, he's pretty sharp as well. So Jim's a great guy. And he's, like, for his car and stuff with his car and when we're maintaining it, he's a great driver, because he can tell us exactly what's working right or what's not working right. Yes. You don't see too many of those, no. You see, You don't, and I think with something that's like that, you don't put in a car that you're afraid to lose or part with. Because lots of people, I drive a Mazda Miata in the summer. It's the newer series Mazda Miata. There's no way I would ever take that into this, because at the end, you just don't know what's going to happen. And one of the guys on our crew last year, he had a BMW 3 Series car. It was an E46, so about a 2003, 2004. He'd spent probably about $15,000 on the car when it all was said and done, and he lost that car in it. Just spun out, was going a little bit too fast. Hit a guardrail, broke a subframe, smashed up the body, and it just wasn't worth fixing. And so we talk about this all the time. If you're in it on the cheap, you're probably best to buy like an old Mazda Miata that you could get for $1,500, throw some work into it. An old Mustang body, the old Fox body Mustangs from the 1980s, those ones. But you don't put anything nice in it, or you don't put anything rare or unusual. The guy who had the Zed car that he built, when him and I were talking about that, because when he heard I used to work for Nissan, we talked about all what he had done, all the work he had done. And after he'd been through it once, it's like, I'm not taking this car through this again. You see enough cars that are just damaged or really totaled, and you don't put anything in that you really value and want to keep in something in any racing.
Yes.
The most popular car would be Subaru STI. Yeah, the current body style or the previous body style. Those are WRX and STIs are probably the most popular. Evos, Mitsubishi Lancer Evo is popular. And then after that, it's a mishmash of everything. You've got Porsche 911s. You've got Mustangs, you've got new Mustangs, you've got Corvettes, you've got old vintage Mustangs. There's a guy from California, a real estate agent, who he takes a 1968 Mustang Fastbacks, what he takes on it. But that's what he does. He takes that down to Mexico as well and rallies. Yes? No. Fuel cell's just your tank. It's just a reinforced tank that's inside the vehicle, not at the back. So, and that's so that if you get hit or if you get into an accident, you're not going to get a fire from the fuel tank. Yes. We've got there's automotive programs all over in Ontario. We're the only college that sends students to something like this. And so at the end, there's no other colleges there, not even the college in St. John's, because that comes up to it. But I know the administrators at the college in St. John's, and it just comes down to budget and it comes down to risk. And people are really worried. And if I didn't have a faculty who was used to racing and really understood it, we probably wouldn't have explored it first at all either. Because my first year, I just sent Garrett to check it out because I knew he was going to be okay on his own. And when he came back and said, yeah, I really think I could get students. And when we were encouraged to try and can you send more students out, Garrett and I talked about it, and no, we're not supervising any more than two students at a time, just because we're so risk is probably why in an event like this colleges probably aren't involved. The risk would be somebody gets hurt. The risk would be something's done to a vehicle and someone gets hurt, it comes apart, the driver gets killed, something like that. Because if you think about it, yeah, if you're checking the suspension components, if you're checking the brakes, if you're overhauling something or repairing something, if you're pulling the suspension apart and you've got bent stuff that you can't replace, someone's got to make the call, is this car safe to drive or is it not safe to drive? So at the end of the day, Garrett and I are okay with that. Because we've, with the BMW that the guy lost that I was talking about, Ron's BMW, he wanted to fix it. And he wanted to weld up some subframes and go. Because you're two-thirds the way through the week. You want to finish. I was the one that put my foot down and said, no, it's not that. Nobody's fixing that car and nobody's driving it. I had a guy with a welder right then and there that wanted to get the car going. So anything related to government nowadays is more aware of what are the risks, what could happen if things don't go right. So so that's something you got to consider. Yes. It varies. They were over 100 cars at one time, but after the meltdown in the financial sector in 2008, 2009, they dropped below 50 cars. Now they're just borderline with, is it viable? So they're sitting around around 30 cars to 40 cars. So it's running again this year. But they probably have to find a way to attract more people into it again. They were up over 100 at one time, but although they said when there were 100 cars, that was too many, because it just means they've got to shut the towns down for too long, and that becomes an issue, and it's just too packed. And when you have in Newfoundland, when you have 100 cars coming into the town for the night, you've got the crews with them. So like with the Hume group, with four cars or five cars, they've got an entourage of probably 15 people that are coming in. So that's a lot of people coming in to a town to try look for lodging, all of that kind of stuff. Some of them stay in campers, some of them stay in hotels, some of them will bill it with people if they're, so a whole variety, yeah. So that's it. So that's Targa, everyone. So I really appreciate the opportunity. Thanks.